This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I've got Carrie Jr. II, the show's producer, with us in the studio.
Howdy.
Hey. The idea of big colleges in this country is so central to the idea of higher ed. It's really one of the places that higher ed for the masses, for lots and lots of people, got its start. And here in Michigan, we've got one of these land-grant institutions, as they're called, Michigan State University, which was created because the federal government granted them a bunch of land that they could then sell to finance the start of the university. It's a story that I think lots of us have heard of or think about when we think about universities. But there's a flip side to that story. Where did that land come from? Where did the government get the land to sell to states first, to be able to sell to these colleges to make this money? And the answer is it took this land, sometimes through brutal force, from Native American tribes that owned it. They were here and it was their land. The U.S. government took it from them and sold it to start these colleges.
Yeah. I mean, you can't separate the two. And higher education also is seen as an economic mobility ladder, like an avenue to greater financial prosperity nowadays in America. So you got to think about that side of the coin as well. So we came across an investigative report about 14 land-grant institutions that continue to profit from their land. So not just initially when they were given the land to grow, but now they use that land to make money off of it as well. This was a report published in 2020 by GRIST, which is a nonprofit media organization that's dedicated to highlighting climate solutions and uncovering environmental injustices. Their research and reporting goes further to talk about how these institutions are using the land to extract resources that then have environmental impacts on the area and the land itself. But we want to focus mostly on the acquisition of the land and the profit of the land. And to do that, we're going to be joined by Tristan Atone, who is the editor-in-large of the GRIST publication.
Yeah. There's a very rich history behind all of this. This happens during the Civil War and is fueled by massive change in the population and in the idea of education. And the Native American part of this gets completely forgotten, just washed over. No one stops to say, hey, wait a second. We're taking this land from some other people because it was considered one, right? They won this land in the wars, quote unquote, that they were fighting against Native people. But today, of course, when you look at that, there's no question that that's a form of exploitation and in some cases really violent exploitation that produced this bounty that was used to create the higher ed system in so many states that exist today.
And it's that legacy, too, that we want to explore of like what do these institutions now represent for Native American people,
sure.
And how does that play into their ability to access higher education?
Tristan Atone, welcome to Create an Equal.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start by talking briefly about Ishii. Who was he and why is he important to this story, this bigger story you're telling about land-grant universities?
Good question. Ishii was a sort of a figure in California Indian history. He's reasonably well-known in indigenous communities, but more or less was sort of framed as the last of his tribe. He'd been living out in sort of his tribe's traditional homelands toward the end of the 18th or 19th century. And essentially, part of Ishii's story is that when he came out of hiding, he was brought to the University of California, where he worked as a janitor to make ends meet. There's not a ton known about him out there, but he's sort of important to this larger story because his land was more or less taken by the University of California and sold out from underneath him in order to fund the institution that eventually ended up paying him, basically.
Yeah. So the reason I think that's a great story is that it personalizes this issue, but it also just kind of vividly portrays the taking aspect of this issue. And I just don't think it's something that most of us think about when we think about universities and land-grant universities in particular. You've been doing extensive reporting on how these land-grant universities acquired the land that they're on. And of course, we want to talk about that. But we probably need to start even before that at just some definition. Let's talk about what land-grant universities are and why they have a distinct history and status.
Yeah, so land-grant universities are essentially a system of institutions that were founded by Abraham Lincoln. These institutions are mainly were mainly created for agriculture and technical education, as well as some military education. So we're the original sort of land-grant universities were 52 universities signed into law in 1862. You likely know them because they're the, you know, usually have they have state attached to the name. So
the big state schools, University. Right.
Yeah, big state schools, Texas A&M, Michigan State, etc. You likely know these institutions, but they're fairly old institutions. And again, they're sort of unique in that they were founded as a system, and what they required and why they're called land-grant universities isn't because they were built on land that was given to them. They're not, I mean, some of them are, but they're called land-grant universities because they were given land more or less to sell in order to sort of raise money for their endowment. So basically, once being built, they were given different sizes, different acreage of land, depending on state. And those institutions were able to more or less get off the ground because of that land. And of course, I think in terms of our reporting, we were able to sort of make a connection between the land that was given to the institutions to be sold and connect it back to the tribes that that land was taken from. So I think a lot of folks, when we sort of hear about, oh, well, land-grant institutions were built on with indigenous land, isn't really a far stretch because, you know, it's more or less the United States is built on indigenous land. And but being able to sort of find the receipts and pinpoint this information down to dollar amounts and actual tribes and treaties and or outright seizures is quite different in terms of our journalism to be able to sort of make those very, very concrete connections.
Yeah. So let's talk about how this happened, the sort of practical end of it. Let's say I want to start Michigan State University here in the state of Michigan. How do you get the land to do it? And what's the process that's used to either, I guess, buy or take from indigenous tribes?
Well, so in the 1800s, as the United States was expanding westward, U.S. officials either made treaties with tribes or outright seized land through combat, basically. So the process here is that if you want to give universities land that they can sell, you first have to acquire that land. And that's usually those two options, treaties, combat, and in some cases like California, unratified treaties, where the state officials came in, made treaties with tribes there to establish California, sent those treaties to Washington, D.C. to be ratified by Congress. Congress said, no, we're not going to do that, and more or less cheated those tribes out of those lands by not ratifying those treaties. So that's one other way that can happen.
Yeah.
So more or less, you have to have this process of acquiring land. And that's the first step is actually bringing that land in. That territory usually becomes a territory and then into a state. Once you become a state, you go to the federal government and you say, we're going to establish a university. The federal government, depending on your population size, more or less grants that land, that newly acquired land, to your institution to then sell. So, big picture for all 52 universities at 1862, under the 1862 Act, we're talking about 11 million acres of indigenous land that we found to be taken from about 250 tribal nations through about 160 different treaties and or land seizures for those original founding institutions.
And let's talk about the relationship, I guess, here between government officials and indigenous people and tribes at this time. The way you describe it suggests that some of this could have been cooperative. Some of this could have been, well, I want to give this to you because you're going to give me money or you're going to give me something else in exchange. Of course, there are other instances, and I want to talk about those too, where they're just taking the land. But were there any circumstances that you would describe as fair in this process? I mean, is any of this actual commerce as opposed to some form of exploitation?
I mean, I think the short answer is no. I mean, I don't think anybody has yet to see a treaty that was fully honored or put into place without some sort of threat of violence. Mm. This is sort of what the Indian Claims Commission went over for almost 70 years in terms of trying to settle this a lot of these situations in court. Most, if not all, treaties, usually had some sort of element of violence attached to them. Is that, as settlers moved in, saying that we are going to move here regardless whether you like it or not. So you can either take a monetary-like settlement, or, as in the case of Arizona, you can fight it out. There are no treaties, for instance, for Arizona, right? Like those are lands taken from Apache people, Tohono O'odham people. There are more than 20 different indigenous nations in Arizona, and none of them have treaties with the United States because it was settled through combat, basically. Mm. Minnesota is a great example, even Michigan as well, too, is that there's always coercion in these situations. So usually when you get to a treaty situation, you've already gone through a coercive sort of process, whether that's going through combat or whatever else. And I would also remind, I guess, for listeners, is that the treaty making process was usually completed by the federal government, typically because tribes couldn't be defeated militarily.
I see.
There are examples of where that's not the case, but typically the treaty making process was because military action was not feasible for the fledgling United States.
Yeah. So let's talk about the money here. I mean, you report that 11 million acres is ultimately transferred to these universities. How much did the United States spend to acquire that land? And then how much did it raise for these universities?
Well, I mean, by our calculations, the United States paid these 250 tribes approximately $400,000. And I guess for listeners, I would caution in terms of that's an average of where payment was actually made, mm-hmm. Averaged with where there was no payment made. For instance, again, California, no mm-hmm. payments made to tribes, right. For instance. So it's kind of that idea of like, if there's 10 people in the bar and like Bill Gates walks in, like the average income for the bar is
goes
like,
way up.
Is like $10 million per person in the bar, right? So right. I think it's important to keep that in mind for statistics. But at least when we adjusted for 2020 dollars, when our initial reporting came out, We found that universities were able to make about $495 million for their endowments off of those initial lands, and also found that a number of universities also held on to those lands too and continue to profit through, you know, grazing leases or oil and gas exploration. I'm sure we'll get to that later. But, you know, from our calculations, about $495 million off of 10.7 million acres that were taken and then given to these institutions.
Yeah. I mean, so that's, I mean, that is exponential growth, obviously, in the value of these lands. I mean, it's really hard to sit and even think of or kind of fathom how big a boost this ends up being to these universities.
Well, not only just the buy sell ratio is just is just astronomical. I mean, I think it's also important to remember that like institutions like Nebraska State would not have gotten off the ground without this.
They couldn't
land
have started, right?
Money.
Yeah,
yeah. Minnesota, couldn't have gotten their university off the ground after it failed the first time, and they needed this, this act to get back, back in line and open the doors again. So, some of these institutions had, 20, 30 people in their very first opening year, even less in some cases. So more or less like. This is the investment that most of these institutions needed to get off the ground. So, and I think one of the things that we sort of like talk about in terms of how these institutions were given land and continue to profit off of land these days, as sort of, it's sort of America's original Nepo babies here. Yeah. Like they're not getting off the ground any other way.
Right. So this is all happening because Congress decides that this is what they want to do to help higher ed get started, I imagine. Is anyone pausing at the time to say, isn't this wrong? I mean, isn't there something about this that doesn't quite sit right, that we're giving so much to these universities and the people who want to start them and taking from Native Americans? And I'm asking that purposely in a sort of, I guess, a false naivete. I mean, I think I know the answer to that. But I think it's important to talk about the way in which U.S. officials thought of Native peoples back then and the inhumanity that was assigned to them, to their culture, to their nations.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't a conversation that's happening at almost any level of government. In the 1800s and before, the United States is expanding westward, and it's this idea of manifest destiny. This idea that all of North America is going to be, the United States. It's inevitable. There's nothing that can be done to stop it. So there's no question about morals or ethics. It's probably a different conversation altogether to talk about how, U.S. officials or, settlers or, first or second generation Americans thought of indigenous peoples. This is more or less sort of the history of America of not seeing its original inhabitants as humans, and also expecting that the United States would expand from the Atlantic to the Pacific and beyond.
When you think of Ishii, back to the sort of beginning of this story, as you say, he ends up working at a land grant university that took his land. What kind of work does he end up doing, and what kind of compensation is he getting for that work?
No, if I recall, he was a janitor, and I believe he was paid something like $25 a month by the university for his work. And again, that in that time period,
it's more money than it is today. Clearly, right.
Well, that's true. It is more money than it is today, but it is also, I mean, where the money comes from is, you know, from Ishii's land, right? Yeah. So, like, you know, they're more or less, you know, more or less the federal government and California settlers are essentially engaged in genocide. It's something that the state of California has used that term as well for the clearing of indigenous peoples from its lands. So there's an active campaign of genocide that is happening in California that is clearing that land, making it available to the University of California to acquire and then sell and then use much of that income to pay wages on the university at the university, including, as far as I recall, Ishii's wage as well. So it's this it's a pretty ugly sort of circle of how Ishii ends up in that situation and where his payment is more or less coming from. Hmm.
Okay, we need to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will continue talking with reporter Tristan Atone about land-grant universities, where they come from, where they got their money, and what they maybe owe as a result. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. We're back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you've joined us. We're talking today with Tristan Atone. He's a writer and reporter, a member of the Kiowa tribe. He's an editor-at-large at GRIST, which is a nonprofit independent media organization that's dedicated to highlighting climate solutions and uncovering environmental injustices. Today, we're talking about land-grant universities, these very large, mostly state universities in our country, where they come from, what that means, land-grant, and how it connects to the inequality of the treatment that Native peoples have suffered at the hands of white settlers and the United States for a very long time. Tristan, I want to talk a little more about how universities make or raise money from this land. So the land gets taken from these Native tribes. It is given to the universities explicitly for them to make money off of so that they can build and become successful. What does that look like? Is it just sale of the land, or are there other things involved?
Well, it's mostly sale of those original lands, and especially for universities that are on the East Coast. So there are some private universities, for instance, like Cornell or MIT, that were also land-grant institutions and given land. But, you know, East Coast, you know, there's this sort of bifurcation of East Coast and West Coast universities. Universities on the East Coast more or less didn't have any public lands inside their borders anymore to give to universities. So they were given sort of coupons called scrip for newly acquired lands in the West as the nation expanded westward. And then the Western universities, which are given land within more or less their borders or territorial borders. Again, most universities sold their lands pretty quickly in order to sort of bring in, you know, quick cash for their endowments. But there were, what we found, at least in our initial reporting from 2020, was there were another 16 universities that held on to a large number of their Morrill Act lands. And a lot of them are used for, you know, for generating revenue, grazing, some commercial leasing, a lot of oil and gas. More or less, these universities figured out that if they could hold on to them for a longer period of time, there were ways to capitalize even larger. So, you know, there are some institutions that are still profiting off of those initial lands that were given to them in the 1800s. So that's one act that's benefited them, and they continue to make money off of. Additional acts have granted lands to those universities also.
And let's talk about oil and gas, mining, fossil fuels, the tie-in here to that kind of development and the money for these universities.
Yeah, so pause for a second here to say that these initial 52 universities become universities through the Morrill Act, through the Land Grant Act. Mm-hmm. There is and many of them still hold those lands from the 1800s that were given to them. What reporting we've been doing recently really focuses on something called enabling acts. So, when there's a territory is going to become a state, that state needs to pass an enabling act so it can enter the union, right? So through enabling acts, most states that pass enabling acts also have language in them for the federal government to provide them land for their public institutions. So you've got the Morrill Act lands that are coming in. And then when you become a state, the Enabling Act gives you even more land on top of that. And our recent investigations have really been looking at lands that come through those Enabling Acts. Same concept, it's land taken from indigenous peoples that are then used for these different public institutions. And we were looking at states in which Enabling Acts provided lands to these land-grant universities as well. We found there were 14 land-grant institutions which generate revenue from about 8.2 million surface and mineral acres. Most of that, about 25% of that land is designated for either fossil fuel production or the mining of minerals like coal or taconite. Mm-hmm. So these are lands that we're really beginning to track now and sort of expand on a little bit more in terms of thinking about all the ways in which these institutions continue to profit off indigenous land and resources. And this is one other act which focuses on land that enriches these institutions.
Yeah. So in modern terms, what do the universities say about this money, about this process, about this history, that their very beginnings, their very existence from the start depends on having had someone take this land from Native peoples and give it to them and allow them to sell it or, as you point out, to make money off of it in ways that no one probably could have imagined.
Well, yeah, it's a good question. Many institutions acknowledge this history. Others flat out ignore it. We've seen a lot of institutions, for instance, like Washington State University, rewrote its land acknowledgement, about how the institution got started. It also pledged to commission a team to determine reconciliation plans. Texas A&M is kind of working toward assembling a task force also to sort of better understand the history of the Morrill Act and its impact on the institution and tribes. We've seen like a lot of teach-ins at institutions like Cornell, for instance, which was the largest Morrill Act beneficiary, staff and faculty have launched a project to document the university's financial windfall. Mm-hmm. We've seen like there are a lot of places that are actually beginning to lean into this history pretty heavily and taking steps, maybe slow steps, but still steps to sort of understanding what this history means for them and what their role and in some cases even what how they can address this history. As I said, a lot of other institutions have completely ignored it. A lot of states, schools in the South, for instance, have almost completely ignored everything from requests for comment to any of the historical sort of analysis that's going on. It really just depends on the institution, but I would say some are grappling with it okay, but none of them are really grappling with it in a way that I think indigenous staff and faculty would like to see them do.
Yeah. It seems like maybe it's just kind of forgotten in a reparative sense. Let's talk about the presence, though, of Native peoples at these universities, students, faculty. I am a graduate of the University of Michigan, but I spend a lot of time at Michigan State because I've got a student that is belongs to me who was enrolled there. When I go to these places, and of course, the University of Michigan was not a land grant university, but Michigan State was. I don't see a formidable presence of native of peoples, which would be perhaps one way that you might think of trying to repair the damage that was done by this. But is that happening? Is that being done with intention to try to make up for all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a lot of calls for like free tuition at these institutions. That's not really happening a whole lot. Presence, I think, is – we can get back to that. But presence is really a big thing. I mean, Michigan State, for instance, when we collected data on Michigan State, I think there were 50,000 students in 2018. Mm-hmm. Only 104 of them were Native American or Alaska Native. Wow. You know, this is not unusual. Usually it's a pretty small number of Native students that are at these institutions. And yeah, I think there are many, many ways in which scholars and academics and folks that work in these systems have thought about what reparations can look like. And, you know, free tuition is basically the easiest thing that you can do. I mean, 104 students is not going to break the bank.
Right.
These are some of the things to sort of like look at. But generally, there aren't a ton of Native students at these institutions. And usually the barrier for entry is just the massive amount of money that it takes to go to college.
It's expensive, sure.
Yeah, very.
What about trying to tie current profits from this land to reparative efforts? I mean, you point out that a lot of these schools are still making money off of what they were initially given. They didn't just sell the land. They've found ways to monetize it. Is there ever a discussion about whether you could help fix, well, you know, the taking aspect of this by trying to reimburse tribes in some way? Not that you ever could, but in other contexts, I guess, is part of what I'm getting at. This is how we think of reparative work. This is how we think of how we fix things that were done wrong in the past. Has that discussion surfaced here at all?
I mean, I guess I can't say that it really has. I think, these institutions are big and they move slowly, but and we see a lot of action that's happening from students, staff, and faculty. But from an administration level, I can't say that there's a ton of conversation that we're seeing around this. I think that if that is going to happen in the future, it's going to be because of students, staff, and faculty that are holding their institutions accountable. But, you know, what reparations, what restitution, what reparative justice actually looks like, I think it's different from university to university. Hmm. And I think that's something that universities really have to figure out on their own on some level. I think, I think part of the conversation is that they could be reaching out to indigenous nations that were impacted by their actions and activities to start working on what those plans could look like. But, you know, it's really hard to make a plan for like how you make things right if you're not talking to the people that you wronged.
That you wronged, right. What about the tribes that had this land taken? I mean, of course, the native population in this country is not what it used to be, but how much presence is there in these states of tribes to even raise their hands and say, hey, you know, this was done and it wasn't right and we'd like to make it right?
Well, I think there's a lot. I mean, I don't remember how many tribal nations are in Michigan off the top of my head here, mm-hmm. but most states in the West have, impacted tribal nations that are within their borders.
Yeah.
And I think I think this is one of the things that universities need to keep in mind is that it's not on the tribes to come to the university to say, hey, you did us wrong, like you need to fix it. It's up to the universities, right?
To say,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if I, Stephen, if I come to your house and I, drive over your front lawn or something like that. It's not up to you to come to me and tell me that you messed it up, that I messed it up, right? Like I need to come back and say, "Rick, I'm really sorry I did that," you know. I think that's really how. I know it sounds a little oversimplistic to say that that's how apologies work, but it's how apologies work. That's how you build a better future. Is that you're talking to the people that you have harmed. And making sure that you're thinking of a future together. And until those conversations happen, there is no future together.
So when I think of higher ed and I think of reparative work, I mean, you have universities doing some pretty extraordinary things, trying to document things that they've done to people in the past, trying to come up with ways to fix it. I'm thinking specifically of Georgetown University, which got called out for slave sales that the priests there engaged in early on, a very similar kind of story in order to help the university survive. Their response to that was to come up with ways to help the families of those slaves now and those former slaves now and try to make it right. Lots of universities, of course, have DEI programs these days, and some of them are under fire. But at most universities, they're at least gesturing in a way that says we want to get this right. I guess I wonder why this isn't happening for Native peoples. What is it about this that doesn't rise to the level of these other wrongs that they seem perfectly willing to at least contemplate? And I don't think anyone would say they're getting it 100% right, but there is an effort and there's certainly an acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to the reparative efforts for slavery at institutions. That was a big inspiration for our reporting and project in terms of looking at how these institutions have begun to engage with that history. Uh-huh. But what I can say is that I do think that there is one big difference here is that when it comes to reparative efforts for this history, I think what we're actually talking about here is really upending almost the entire history of the United States. And on some level, I think we're talking about upending property law in the U.S. I mean, this idea that one day you come and steal my bicycle and every day I have to see you riding my bicycle by. And I'm like, hey, man, I really like my bicycle.
I'd like that back.
And you're like, look. I'll put a plaque on it and say that this used to be your bicycle. I'm right. Like, okay, I mean, I guess that's fine, but I'd still like the bicycle back. You know, like you're still on the bicycle no matter what.
Right.
And no matter how many plaques you put on it or how many, if you ride by me and you say, I recognize that this was your bicycle. Like basically, like I still want the bicycle back. And I do think that is one of the biggest conversations that's been happening for the last 10 years here is this idea of land back. And what does that actually mean? What does that mean for states? What does that mean for universities, for churches, for any institution that is more or less engaged in this behavior in the past? Like there's really, I think, only one really true reparative justice here when it comes to stolen land and resources. And that's a conversation that absolutely nobody wants to have.
Because of the difficulty of figuring that out or the moral difficulty of confronting it?
I mean, moral difficulty, I actually don't think it's all that hard to figure out, honestly. But, I think this is a conversation about power, you know, like is the state of Michigan willing to give up like hundreds of thousands of acres of land to make something right?
Right.
Like that's a conversation about power, not justice.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Tristan Ottone, it was really great to have you here for this conversation about land-grant universities. Thanks so much for joining us on Created Equal.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined by Steve Yanni, who is the land grant director for Bay Mills Community College up in the UP here in Michigan. He's going to tell us about tribal colleges and the land grants that helped get them started. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Welcome back to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson. We just heard about the history of land-grant universities in this country and how that history ties into the theft of land from Native peoples. But that's not really the whole story. There are also instances where land-grant programs have been used to support tribal colleges, colleges that are focused on increasing access for Native peoples. We have some right here in the state of Michigan. And so we wanted to talk with someone from one of these colleges to hear how that works and whether it does benefit Native communities. We're going to talk with Steve Yanni, who is the land grant director at Bay Mills Community College, which is way, way up in the UP on Lake Superior, about what goes on up there and how the land grant process plays a role in the college's success. Steve Yanni, it's great to have you here with us. Welcome to Created Equal.
Thank you very much, and greetings from Eastern Upper Michigan on the shores of Lake Superior.
Yes, right. So I want to talk first about Bay Mills Community College. It's one of four land-grant colleges in Michigan. It's a little different than some of the other land-grant universities. Talk about that difference as well.
Well, it took all the way until 1994 for the tribal colleges and universities across the country to be afforded this status as part of the land-grant family. And today we have 35 tribal colleges and universities, or 1994s as they're referred to. The tribal colleges, when they were established within the land-grant system, were not provided grants of land. So that's a little different in terms of the history of, of the land grant system. So those, you know, in 1862, each state was granted that land.
Actual land, yeah.
Actual land, which they sold and used the proceeds to develop the land grant college within that state. Instead, there are funds that tribal colleges can access to fund their land grant operations. And one of those funds is an endowment that the college uses in lieu of, I guess, a grant of land to fund operations of the college.
When you talk about the role of the college as it relates to the Native people of that area, talk about how important that is the role that this institution of higher ed is playing for the Anishinaabe folks.
The first tribal college was established in 1968. It was then called Navajo Community College, now Navajo Technical University. The role that higher education plays here in Bay Mills Indian community is one that I think focuses on the notion that, you know, tribal nations can certainly stand shoulder to shoulder with everyone else across the country with the inclusion of higher education as part of the scene within the tribal communities. So education is seen as front and center in terms of the ability of tribal nations, and certainly this particular tribal nation here at Bay Mills, to be part of the network of the modern society of the United States. If we have access to affordable, accessible, and meaningful higher education, and a higher education that recognizes that there are different ways of knowing. There are different histories, and these histories impact us all in ways that we need to understand today, but be able to move forward in a way that allows access and affordability to all folks, certainly tribal citizens, part of that picture.
Yeah. Let's talk about the students at a place like Bay Mills, what they're doing, and the connection they have to this history of land grant and of tribal colleges.
Sure. So our students represent a vast swath of society, I guess I would say. We are required by law to have 50% plus one of our students be members of federally recognized tribes. And that's really unique to tribal colleges. No other type of higher education institution has that sort of requirement. The majority of our students come from two tribes in the eastern and upper peninsula, the Bay Mills Indian community and the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians. And then the Little Traverse Bay Band is our third largest group in terms of tribal enrollment.
When you think of the students who are enrolled there, do you feel like these are students who, but for Bay Mills, wouldn't have an opportunity at higher ed? I mean, how much of the opportunity is this kind of, I guess, presenting to them?
We know that tribal students who begin their higher education journey at a tribal college are far more successful than those who begin their higher education journey at a mainstream institution. Now, that's not to say that tribal members can't be successful in a mainstream institution. Certainly, there are many who have been very successful. But overall, as a general rule, we know that tribal members are more likely to be successful if they start at a tribal college for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's the reason for that?
I think certainly connection to culture is a big reason. I think also physically being located within tribal communities is another reason. You know, we know well that tribal members have this great connection to their communities, to the land and waters that their communities are next to. Mm. So not being pulled away from those traditional sources of sustenance, of support, of family, is really important in terms of their ability to be successful. And also at our institution, any member of a federally recognized tribe does not pay any tuition. So we try to remove that financial barrier as well. You know, a lot of our students are first generation college students. Sure. A lot of them are single parents. And their support is really woven into the communities where they live. So they're not pulled away from that support and being able to access higher education here. And that's very important.
Yeah. Okay, Steve Yanni, Land Grant Director and an Accreditation Liaison Officer for Bay Mills Community College. Really great to have you here to give us a peek into the world of tribal colleges. Thanks for joining us on Created Equal.
Thank you. We're always glad to share what we're doing here at Bay Mills, and we greatly appreciate the opportunity today.
As someone who attended a historically black college, I deeply sympathize with wanting to attend a college that aligns with your culture and build space for you.
Right.
Steve Yanni spoke pretty strongly about how those schools cater to their tribes more so than the major institutions do. And that is very, very much the same reason I think black students attend HBCUs. Have you heard of tribal colleges before we talked about this?
I have heard of tribal colleges before. I didn't know what they were, and I didn't know their history. So it was really interesting to hear Steve Yanni from Bay Mills talk about that. I know what Bay Mills is, but I didn't know anything about the college.
Did you? And so land-grant institutions, Michigan State, for me, was the only institution in the state that I knew of that had land-grant status. I didn't know the history. But I also didn't know that tribal colleges had land-grant status either. Does that reframe anything for you?
Well, I mean, I think, like we said, it brings things kind of full circle, right? Because land-grant universities were founded with land taken from Native people, mm-hmm. and now you've got tribal colleges that are getting some resources mm-hmm. from a land grant program that's mm-hmm. not the same, but similar minded. So, I mean, that's I'm not sure if that makes it better what mm-hmm. happened. It certainly doesn't excuse what happened.
Right.
But is it a part of reparation? Maybe. That'll do it for us on Created Equal. Be sure to listen to our recent episodes at WDET.org, and we would love if you would subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Kerry Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is done by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.